From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, one of the stars of The Sopranos, Joe Pantoliano. He plays Ralphie, a made man with no conscience, who has lost the trust and respect of nearly everyone around him, including Tony. Pantoliano has appeared in over 60 films, including Risky Business, The Matrix, and Memento. Now he has a memoir about growing up in Hoboken, New Jersey, with his mother who was a bookie and his stepfather who was connected. His book is called Who's Sorry Now? The True Story of a Stand-Up Guy. And linguist Jeff Nunberg talks about presidents, language, and the pronunciation of nuclear as nuclear. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Iraq has agreed to arrangements for the resumption of UN weapons inspections. Hans Blix, the chief weapons inspector, said the Iraqis have agreed that the inspection teams will have unconditional access to all sites except the 8 Iraqi presidential palaces.
It was clarified that all sites are subject to immediate, unconditional, and unrestricted access. However, the Memorandum of Understanding of 1998 establishes special procedures for access to 8 presidential sites.
That memorandum doesn't prevent inspectors from visiting the presidential sites, but it does make special arrangements for their inspection. Secretary of State Colin Powell said today's agreement doesn't go far enough.
We can even see today that there are still places that are off limits that were not talked about.
Powell said the failure to gain unrestricted access to all Iraqi sites is another reason why the UN Security Council must approve a new resolution that will make it clear what's expected from Iraq. A federal court in Detroit is holding a public hearing on a man who's accused of running an Islamic charity that's alleged to have links to al-Qaeda. Rabi Haddad has been in jail since last December when he was arrested on a visa violation. He's asking the court to release him on bond. Haddad told the court today that he's being unjustly detained and that he doesn't pose any threat to U.S. national security. Haddad helped establish the Global Relief Foundation. The Justice Department says the charity has received substantial funding from a man who's suspected of providing money to al-Qaeda terrorists. Another setback today in attempts to end the lockout of dock workers at West Coast ports. Officials from the Longshore and Warehouse Union abruptly walked out of a negotiating session with a federal mediator when they discovered that shipping company representatives had brought armed guards to the meeting. More from NPR's Ina Jaffe.
The president of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, Jim Spinoza, accused shipping company representatives of hiding behind armed thugs. The meeting with the federal mediator was called to seek a way of ending the shipping company's lockout of longshore workers. The union and the Pacific Maritime Association, which represents the shippers, have been in contentious contract negotiations since May. Management called the lockout after what it claimed was a slowdown staged by union members. The union has denied the charge. The Pacific Maritime Association, or PMA, called the union's reaction unfortunate. The PMA said that the armed guards were not actually in the meeting room and were bodyguards recently hired to protect PMA President Joe Mineachi. They encouraged the union to return to the bargaining table. Ina Jaffe, NPR News, Los Angeles.
In stocks, the Dow gained 347 points, or 4.5%, to close at 7,938. The Nasdaq gained 42 points. This is NPR News. The House has passed a bill that would authorize $100 million for programs designed to reduce the spread of West Nile virus. The money would come in the form of grants to help communities develop mosquito control programs. A similar bill is making its way through the Senate. NASA is delaying the launch of Space Shuttle Atlantis because of concerns that Hurricane Lily may threaten Houston, Texas, the home of Mission Control. Launch managers are shifting the launch from tomorrow to Thursday. Pat Duggins reports from member station WMFE.
NASA says this is the first time a shuttle launch in Florida has been delayed because of weather concerns in Houston. If Hurricane Lily threatens the Texas coast, the Johnson Space Center could face serious damage. Delicate equipment on the roof of Mission Control is designed only to withstand winds of 50 miles per hour. Also, the Space Center is in a low-lying area between Houston and Galveston, which is subject to flooding. Air Force forecasters will watch the progress of Hurricane Lily and meet again in the morning. Mission managers could press ahead with launch plans for Thursday or postpone the liftoff again. Five astronauts and a Russian cosmonaut make up the crew of Space Shuttle Atlantis. Their mission is to deliver a 30,000-pound section of the exterior framework of the International Space Station. For NPR News, I'm Pat Duggan in Orlando.
Louisiana's governor has declared a state of emergency as Lily sets a course toward the U.S. Gulf Coast. Much of South Louisiana is under a hurricane watch just days after it was drenched by Tropical Storm Isidore. Forecasters say Lily could hit the Louisiana coast as early as Thursday evening. The hurricane has grown to a Category 2 storm, blasting western Cuba with winds up to 100 miles per hour. The National Hurricane Center says Lily could have winds of more than 115 miles per hour by the time it hits Louisiana. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, supporting families and neighborhoods by funding initiatives aimed at helping disadvantaged children. On the web at aecf.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Joe Pantoliano has become very popular for his portrayal of a very bad man. He plays Ralph Siffredo on The Sopranos. Ralphie planted the seed in the mind of Jackie Jr., who was nearly his stepson, that he could earn the respect of made men by doing something outrageous. So Jackie Jr. robbed the card game of some made men and ended up killing one of them. Then Ralphie ordered a hit on the boy. Ralphie also beat his girlfriend to death when she was pregnant with his child. Joe Pantoliano has appeared in over 60 films, including Risky Business, The Fugitive, The Matrix, and Memento. Now he has a new memoir called Who's Sorry Now, about growing up in Hoboken, New Jersey in the 50s and early 60s. His parents were on the fringes of crime. His stepfather was connected. Before we meet Pantoliano, let's hear a Sopranos scene from earlier this season. Ralphie is having dinner at the home of Tony and Carmela Soprano. Their teenage son Anthony and his friend are at the table. Ever the bad influence, Ralphie tells them this story.
I ever tell you about the time I had a Harley?
Oh, cool.
74, shovel head. I could blow off Porsches on that thing.
Not my dad's Boxster.
What's your name?
Matt.
Matt, no offense, but your dad's Boxster is a Porsche with panties. Hey, he knows what I'm saying. I mean, that's for the Hamptons, the Boxster. I'm talking Turbo Carrera. One time I'm alongside this Turbo with doctor plates. We come off the line. He's got this big Jew grin. You're not Jewish, are you, Matt?
Half.
Anyway, he knows it's all in fun. We at the intersection Passaic Avenue, New Dutch Lane. We're doing 110. Boom! Right through the light. He wasn't grinning then, boy. I look back. He's white as false teeth.
Jason Mangeli's parents let him get a YZ250.
You get on that bike, I will cut your legs off before the bike does.
I had the high handlebars, you know.
Oh, Stern, don't you got somewhere to be?
Joe Pantoliano, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Right now on The Sopranos, nearly everyone has a reason they want you dead. What are the odds you're going to survive this season?
Well, I can't be an odds maker because I would tip my hand. But I feel quite confident that things are going to turn out just the way they're supposed to.
Well, that's a cagey way of putting it. I'm thinking maybe you're a little too popular now to be knocked off.
Well, wouldn't that be nice?
So when
I tend to agree with you.
Now, in this week's episode of The Sopranos, you're kicked down the stairs by Janice, played by Aida Turturro. Did you have a stunt double? Aida?
It's Aida.
Did you have a stunt double for that, or did that hurt like heck?
I had a stunt double, and that was one of my favorite scenes this season. It was very, very comical, I thought.
Well, speaking of comical, it's a pretty kinky sex scene with you and Aida Turturro before that.
I call it the love scene. What I like about these scenes, it's revealing something about the
dynamics between the characters.
The dynamics of these characters and what...
He gives abuse and he likes taking it in bed.
Yeah, but not only does he like it, I think that he needs to be abused in order to achieve a climax.
Mm-hmm. Ralphie, your character, is not a good man. You have to see things through his eyes. Let's go back to the scene in which you beat your pregnant girlfriend to death. Talk about that scene from Ralphie's eyes.
Well, I would first say that I don't think there's anybody on this show is a good man. I wouldn't say that Tony Soprano is a good man. I think Ralphie is the rottenest apple in the barrel. And what I discovered in playing this part that Ralphie has only performed violence in this show twice. In season three, he beat up the waste management guy, but he taunted him until the guy actually physically tried to beat him up with a baseball bat, and then Ralphie beats him up. With Tracy, his girlfriend, hooker, junkie lover, he actually taunted her to the point where she threw the first blow, which then gave him permission to do violence on her. And I just think that nobody is brought onto this earth bad. Something has to happen along the way. Psychosis, abuse, what have you. I mean, I would imagine that Adolf Hitler was probably a nice little kid at 5 years old. But something drove him to the point of becoming a dictator and murderer, and in the same fashion that would affect a guy like Ralphie. And I think that The Sopranos maybe is going to investigate the whys, what drove a person like this to, how does Ralphie turn out to be Ralphie?
So you think, like in the scene where he beats his girlfriend, he's thinking, she's making me do this because of her behavior.
Well, that's, I think his defense was, what's the big deal? I mean, with Johnny Sack, and, you know, he said, like, what's the big deal? A, she was a hooa. B, she hit me. What was I supposed to do? I was going to let her hit me, go back. If I let her hit me and it gets out, I'm talking as Ralphie now.
Yeah.
And I go back into the Bing and these guys know that this hooker just smacked me in the mouth. How long would I last on the streets? How long would a guy like Ralphie last before somebody clipped him? That's the life.
Now, do you think of Ralphie as having a conscience of, like after the fact, does he feel bad about it?
I think he felt bad about, I mean, whereas Tony Soprano was angry that he disrespected the Bing, that he did it on his property. You know, he was upset, but they didn't do much. They put the girl in a baggie, a plastic bag, and dumped her in a river somewhere. You know, it was a pretty heart-wrenching, violent situation. But I've said this before in interviews, that I think that the most violent thing I've ever seen on The Sopranos was season two, when Tony and the boys extort the guy who has the sporting goods store and basically rape him over a series of months and months and months until there's nothing left.
Right. Can you talk a little bit about the difference between your voice when you're speaking as Joe Pantoliano and your voice when you're speaking as Ralphie?
When I start working on a character, usually by the third, fourth, fifth week, I feel like I wish I could start all over again, because I'm just starting to find him and getting to know him. And I don't know how Ralph evolved. When David Chase called me up and asked me to do Ralphie, basically it was kind of he's an ingenious moment for me in a career that I've really grown to be proud of. But he called me up and he said, listen, we have a new character. He's going to be a really bad guy, but they're all bad guys. And he's going to be funny and charming and eventually become a stone in Tony's shoe. I hadn't read a word of dialogue. And I agreed to be committed to this thing without ever reading anything. And then David started sending this scripts, you know, on a weekly basis. And he's never disappointed me. And the character, I think that the writers get a kick out of putting Ralph in situations. But I certainly get a great kick out of playing him. I mean, if Chase was Shakespeare, he's up there with some of the great villains that Shakespeare's created. Ralph is, I think.
But can you talk literally about your voice, about the accent that you use, the placement of your voice, the whole sound of it, when you're talking as Ralph as opposed to when you're talking as yourself?
You know, I don't really, that's not something I've ever worked on. It's just, I'm around those guys. It's funny, we stopped shooting this thing 2 months ago, and I've already lost like 15 pounds, because there's so much food being consumed on The Sopranos.
On the set?
It's almost like, yeah, on the set, off the set, craft service. It's food, 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 food. One time somebody said, do you think that the Sopranos typecast Italian-Americans as villains? I said, I think it stereotypes Italian-Americans as overeaters. But when I put on the Ralphie clothes, it just kind of, It's like an old pair of shoes. And the clothes kind of take over, and the next thing you know, he has a whole different sound. But it's not something I ever consciously worked on.
Now, your new memoir, Who's Sorry Now, is about your coming of age. And although you're not from a mafia family and your family is nothing like The Sopranos, you weren't unfamiliar with crime when you were growing up, and neither was the rest of your family. Mm-hmm. Did they know about that? The people at The Sopranos, did they know about that when they asked you to be in the cast?
No, not at all. David Chase knew me from 1979 when I did From Here to Eternity, the remake of the novel, and I played Maggio, and he had seen me in that and was interested in putting me in a pilot that was kind of a spinoff when he was working on the Rockford Files. Oh, I didn't get the job, and I saw him infrequently over the years through a mutual friend. And then he called me, and I was available to come, and that's how it happened. But we there was never any kind of flushing out or interviews or tell me about who you, where you came from, background. He had, I don't think, to my knowledge, that he had even an idea that I was from New Jersey.
Well, in fact, you're from Hoboken, New Jersey, and yeah. You write about Hoboken a lot in your new memoir. What, describe a little bit what Hoboken was like when you were growing up. You grew up in the 50s and early 60s.
I think Hoboken has a mystique about it. When I write about Hoboken, I tried very much to make it its own character, like my some of my aunts and uncles and cousins. And there was a tremendous pride being from there. And it was, even though if you go to Hoboken now, it's all gentrified and upwardly mobile, and you really need to have some money to be able to afford to own any property there. But I remember all the bars and all the social clubs, and the social clubs stemmed from the ability to save money. Most of the people, I'd say 85% of the people that lived in Hoboken were blue collar and longshoremen, truck drivers, factory workers, but I remember that the social clubs were a way to get around the liquor license laws, because if you had a social club, you could open up a storefront. You didn't need to have a liquor license. You could sell the alcohol at its cost, so you paid it like an $8 monthly dues fee. The bartenders would, you know, rotate around the membership. And it was a way for a guy to get a nickel beer instead of paying 10 cents.
Thank you. I never really quite understood the social clubs before.
Yeah.
Thank you. Now, tell us what your mother and father did for a living.
Well, Daddy worked at Standard Brands up until 1962 when he had a heart attack.
At Standard
Mommy,
Brands?
Standard Brands in Hoboken, New Jersey, which is now called the Lipton T Building. And it's actually a high-rise apartments. And Mom... She worked at her father's seamstress shop. She was a sewer, and she I remember we would do patches, that she would do piecework. They would cut the sergeant patches and corporal patches and into off of a whole sheet of material, and then she'd get X amount of cents for each piece that she cut. When we went down the shore, for a time, she acted as a bookie working for a local bookie in the area, and that way she could make $4 or $5 a week and enable us to stay down the shore for the summer. I worked for her. I was a runner. She would give me the receipts and the money, and I'd go down to the bakery on the way to the swimming pool and give them their money. And one of the reasons why I wanted to tell this story is in my culture... That is the culture of a New Jersey kid growing up. And I've started to see movies like The Godfather, or I read books like The Fortunate Pilgrim. The women, for me, were always in the background of these assertive, strong men. And my feeling was that the women in my life were much more assertive than the men. And the idea that, you know, Who's Sorry Now is taken from the song that my mother would sing, the Connie Francis song that my mother would sing when she would get the men in her life to blow their stack. She would needle them to the point where they would blow their stack. And I wrote a screenplay first based on my life called Just Like Mona. And the point that I was making in that, and I think I hope that it's the point, that I It took me 45 years to realize that I am just like my mother, that the strengths that I have and the tenacity that I was born with or inherited was from her, not from the men in my life.
My guest is actor Joe Pantoliano. His new memoir is called Who's Sorry Now? We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is actor Joe Pantoliano. He plays Ralphie on The Sopranos. He has a new memoir called Who's Sorry Now? About growing up in Hoboken. When we left off, he was telling us about his mother. Well, let's talk about her some more. You say you were a numbers runner for her. She loved to gamble. What are some of the things she gambled on, and what's the most she ever won or lost?
Oh, my mother loved bingo. My mother could play 16 cards. I had my Aunt Tilly who played 18 cards. That's a lot. And my mother would walk to bingo with a bingo with a bag filled with pennies, probably weighed about 8 pounds. And she would bet on the numbers, you know, the mutual handle, the money that was handled every day at the racetrack. She played the daily double, but she would pick horses by the colors that they wore. In the culture that I came up in, it was a immigrant culture, and people thought that if they could hit the number or if they could hit a horse, that was the way for them to get out of the rat race. You see that today where people are playing lotto day in and day out.
Now, when she recruited you when you were a kid to run numbers for her, did you ever think to yourself, how could she do this to me? This is illegal. It's the kind of thing we could get busted for.
No. I mean, it was so simple. Take this down to the store. It was done ever so lightly. With Cousin Flory, before he died, several years, he was older now, 75, 76, and starting to become frail from emphysema. You know, tobacco killed my entire family. My father from lung cancer, my mother from several strokes and a heart attack, and Flory from emphysema. But Flory one time was telling me that when he was a kid, at like 11 years old, he was delivering heroin, that his grandmother and father and uncle would cut heroin on their dining room table and they would stiff cotton swabs in their nose as to not get the fumes from the heroin. And then little Flory, they put it in little brown vials, glass vials with a cork, and he would go down Mott Street and Hester Street and deliver it. And at that point, that wasn't illegal. In 1922, heroin and cocaine was still legal sale.
Well, you mentioned your cousin Flory. He was your mother's third cousin, and then later in life became your mother's lover and your mm-hmm. stepfather, or perhaps father. When you were, I don't know, about 12 maybe, your mother said to you, your father, he's not really your father. Cousin Flory's your father.
Yeah.
Was Cousin Flory really your father? Did you ever?
I don't think so. I think... Although he was a father figure to me. Somebody asked me this question recently and said, why haven't you ever done DNA to find out for sure? And the truth is that I was blessed with two fathers, and that this man, Florio, came into my life just at the right time when I was just about to fall off the edge of the table. And he was there to catch me, and he saw in me innocence and a future that was robbed from him. He was born into a lifestyle that he never had a chance.
He did a lot of time in a federal penitentiary.
He spent combined time, over 21 years of his life, he spent inside federal penitentiary. So he got out of the life at 51 years old. And so he spent the last 27 years of his life outside of prison working as a working stiff, driving a truck, whatever it took to provide for the family that he chose.
What did he do to land him in the pen?
Well, the last one was heroin trafficking, but he did a variety of things, counterfeiting, hijacking, You know, I, in doing the research for doing the book, I tried to find his papers. I called the FBI and tried to get his rap sheet, but it's gotten too far back. It's too old.
So here's this guy who was, you know, selling heroin and hijacking trucks, et cetera, and he's the guy who prevented you from falling off the edge. What did he do for you? What was going wrong in your life, and how did he help you?
Well, you know, when mommy said that Flory, cousin Flory, was my real dad, I think she did that to protect herself because she was riddled with guilt about taking Flory over daddy. And she was afraid, looking back now, that she was afraid that I was going to take daddy's side. And it was really important for her to be the victim of this. When I talked to my cousin Antoinette, and I reflect on that in the end of the book, when Antoinette said several days before mommy died, or weeks, she said that she was wrong for doing what she did to Monk.
And Monk's the name of your father.
Yeah, my father was Monk, Dominic Monk Pantoliano. But Flory really loved me, and he really wanted the best for me, to the point where he threatened me if I did something wrong, that there would be serious repercussions, and I believed him.
And you hadn't had that before. You hadn't anybody who cared
enough. I never had. By that point, teachers had written me off. My parents were afraid. You see, my mommy and daddy were afraid to go out and reach out and grab at the gold coin. They wanted the best for me, but they didn't want me to be so ambitious because they felt that I'd be hurt. Who was I to think that I was entitled to be an actor? You know, that wasn't there for us or our kind. And I think a lot of my family members felt that way and frightened. Mommy didn't want me, you know, what were people going to say, that I was going to move to New York as a single male at 19 years old? I mean, and they were also really superstitious about all of that stuff. So Flory kept saying, don't worry about it. Do this. You got to do this. Go. He found an actor, and he introduced me to him, and they took me down to HB Studios, and I met Herbert Berghoff. And I was still in high school when I started studying acting.
Joe Pantoliano, he plays Ralphie on The Sopranos. His new memoir is called Who's Sorry Now? He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Sorry now, who's sorry now, whose heart is aching for breaking each one?
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Wiley, publishers of Turning Points, a new book series featuring Columbus and the Americas by author William Least Heat Moon, now at your local BookSense bookseller or wherever books are sold. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with actor Joe Pantoliano, and linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the mispronunciation of nuclear as nuclear.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with actor Joe Pantoliano. He plays Ralphie on The Sopranos. He's appeared in over 60 films, including Risky Business, The Matrix, and Memento. He has a new memoir about growing up in Hoboken with his mother, who was a part-time bookie, his father, who was a gambler, and his stepfather, Flory, who was also his mother's third cousin. Flory spent 21 years in federal penitentiaries. How connected was your cousin Flory, or your stepfather Flory?
Well, Flory was never made. He was never indoctrinated into the organization known as Cosa Nostra. But he was Bilodino Murano, who I talk about in the book, was my great uncle. He was a descendant of the Genovese family. Mommy and Uncle Pete used to run the Italian lottery. That's what Grandpa Gus, Dopey Gus, my grandfather, he organized that, and that was veto sanctioned. So Uncle Pete and Mommy would have to take the money from the Italian lottery to Vito when Vito was a young man. So they all loved Vito, and Vito was a part of their lives. He would go down the shore with them, and Flory was being groomed to be in that. Joe King was a mentor of Florio's, and I remember meeting Joe King when Flory came home from prison, and Flory loved him like a father. Flory also had a father that Joseph Isabella, who had become a user of the same poison that he was selling on the street, heroin, and he died a junkie. So Flory had really strong issues about the use of it. And he, you know, I didn't. As a young adult, I was totally conflicted by what he had done, mm-hmm. but I would never have the courage to confront him on it.
Because your stepfather, Flory, was pretty connected, although he wasn't a made man, and you knew that he'd spend time in the pen, you knew he did a lot of crimes, were you in awe of his status in the crime world, or was that an embarrassment for you? I mean, how did you feel
about
that?
It had serious cachet in the neighborhood to have a guy who was a known wise guy from New York. I mean, the New York City, it was a big deal. People would whisper, and the kids in the neighborhood treated you with respect. It was like having an athlete or a movie star staying over your house.
How much did you want to know about what he'd really done?
Nothing. He'd never brought it home. We didn't know. He was in it very shortly. You know, in the book, I describe when they got arrested, Mommy, my sister Marianne, and Flory, that Sunday afternoon. And it was at that point where we had moved out of the projects. We had moved off of welfare. We were living in Fort Lee. He had spent $10,000 in cash on furnishing this new apartment. And he was waiting to work a deal with his cousins who were in the gas station business that he wanted to get that money. He had $40,000 in cash in 64 or 65. That was a lot of money. And while he was waiting to start a life with that money, he lost it all at the track. He'd go to the Big A every day, and within 4 or 5 months, we were broke again. We were back in the same situation, this time with a lot of fancy furniture.
Now, what was your involvement with crime?
Mine was on the sidelines. You know, I talk about the guys robbing the trains, but I was always the aftermath. You know, I was on the other side of the fence, you know, because I was a kid, you know, but then I was about 11 or 12, so the teenager guys were doing it, and then we would help sell it door to door, like Girl Scout cookies. You know, we'd have whether it was soap or coffee, whatever, or socks, whatever they were getting, and it was a way of doing commerce in my town. I didn't know what it was like to go to a supermarket. Everything was small in Hoboken, little storefronts, And we never went to a clothing store to buy clothing. Everything was bought out of the trunk of a car.
Now, in your memoir, you describe how your mother fought with your father all the time. Lots of four-letter words when they were fighting. No one was going to think about protecting you from from that language. And then when your mother lived with your stepfather, again, lots of big fights. Did you have any sense that two people could live together and actually get along without fighting all the time?
No, in fact, I mean, after 15 years of therapy, I didn't want to be attached to a girl. I mean, during high school, I never had a girlfriend. And I didn't go to the prom when I graduated. And the only reason why I graduated high school was is I thought that I'd be around my mother less that way. At least I'd have to deal with her until 3:30 or 4 in the afternoon. And that's, in fact, by then I started working when I was 12 years old. I worked at my uncle's station, gas station, and I worked at the A&P. And then when I moved to New York, I was a waiter, and I always had a job. I thought that all women were like my mother, and that they would expect, I would expect them to turn into that. I'm still waiting for my wife to turn into my mother. I got one of the sweetest, kindest wives, my wife, Nancy. We've been together 13 years. When I married her, I thought, well, now that we're married, she's going to turn into my mother. I'm still waiting for the other shoe to fall. And she hasn't yet.
Uh-huh.
And I'm surrounded by women, Terry. Everyone. I have three daughters, a nanny. I have my wife, Nancy. The cats are female. And the only male is Abbott, my dog, and me. And we've both been neutered. My wife had me fixed 2 years ago, and Abbott was fixed 8 years ago.
Well, you know, you say in your book that because you were a fat kid and on the short side, you were a real target for abuse from the other kids. Mm-hmm. So sometimes you would, like, entertain them, and that would prevent them from beating you up. But sometimes when you got beaten up, your mother would insist on you telling her who was responsible for it, and she'd go after them, which was really embarrassing for you.
Yeah. I mean, she didn't insist. She just took over. You know, it's kind of hard to come home when your shirt's all torn up and your nose is bleeding and you got a big black eye. And she's going, what happened? Nothing. Don't tell me you're not nothing. You're summoning a bitch. Get over here. And she'd grab one of my friends and put him up against the wall like, you know, James Cagney. Tell me who did this. Right. And then she'd go down and with a stick, you know, the broomstick and just whack the hell out of the kid.
Was that embarrassing or what?
It was horrifying. Was humiliating. And, you know, she was like a battle axe. I mean, she was this big steam engine. She wasn't afraid of anybody.
Joe Pantoliano is my guest, and he's now starring in The Sopranos. He has a new memoir called Who's Sorry Now? Now, when you were growing up, school was really hard. You didn't do very well in school, and you had an undiagnosed case of dyslexia, which was diagnosed later, so that explains why reading was so difficult. When did you end up getting it diagnosed?
Well, I never got it diagnosed. It was just assumed that it was dyslexia because of the way I was spelling things and the fact that I presently, when I was 18 years old, see, I'd been left back three times. When I was a kid in the Hoboken school system, there were 6 months graduating terms, like 1A, 1B, 2A, 2B. When I was in the third grade, I was in 3A, and then they said, well, we're going to just combine it to yearly graduations going on to the next class. So then I got skipped 6 months. So by then, I was really screwed up. I was already behind in the 3A part, right? I should have been in 2B. But it got to be such, I was so riddled with anxiety, I started getting boils. And then by the time I reached high school, I was almost 19 because I'm born in September. So when I graduated my senior year, it was in June. I was going to be 19 in September, and it was in the middle of the year in February, I think it was, when I did the high school play, and never had a need for reading. You know, I watched television all the time. So I didn't really have a need for reading. I watched the nightly news, and I got my information from that. And it got to a point where I realized that this reading thing was something my teacher, Miss Damiano, Mr. Fredericks, they said, look, you have an aptitude for this acting thing. This is something that you could work at and maybe be successful at. But if that's the case, you're going to need to learn how to read. So I read my first book my senior year in high school, and he gave me, I was at gym class, and Mr. Fredericks came and gave me Soul on Ice by Eldridge Cleaver.
That was your first book?
Yeah, he thought it took me 3 weeks, 4 weeks to read it.
Did you like it?
Yeah, I mean, after that, the next book I read was the Valachi Papers, then was The Godfather, you know, things that I could relate to, relatable things.
So I was reading a problem for you when you started acting seriously, or were you good enough by then that you could?
No, it was a. I mean, it took 7 years. It took a long time to. I would have to prepare for an audition. I'd have to put 2 or 3 hours into each audition, and then I would go in. It was like double acting. I would go in and pretend that I was reading off the page, when in fact I had memorized it.
Were you ever caught?
No. I mean, that's the other skill that I learned from Mommy was the ability to be advantageous in getting the job. I had no resume. I had no experience. I had no education. I had no training, and I figured that I could find theaters that had gone out of business, and I would put plays that I worked on in acting class and say that I did them at these theaters because there was no way for them to check up on me. They were out of business. And, you know, it took me 7, 8, 9, it took me 10 years to make a living at this thing, you know?
My guest is Joe Pantoliano. He plays Ralphie on The Sopranos. He has a new memoir called Who's Sorry Now? We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Joe Pantoliano is my guest. He's now one of the stars of The Sopranos. He's written a new memoir, which is called Who's Sorry Now? No, I think your real breakthrough film part was in Risky Business, which was also the movie that launched Tom Cruise's career. And in this movie, Tom Cruise plays a high school kid whose parents are leaving him alone in their big suburban home for a few days while they're out of town. And then he befriends a woman who he doesn't realize is a prostitute who's had a fight with her pimp. She and her girlfriend, who's also a prostitute, are staying at Tom Cruise's house when you, Guido the pimp, shows up to take these two girls home. Let me play a clip from that scene.
I'm afraid I'm going to have to ask you to leave.
Joe, the door's locked. He's starting to give me a stomach ache.
Good. I hope it hurts.
So open the door or what?
Guido, go home. We don't need you anymore.
Look, shut your mouth.
No. Listen, well, maybe we don't work for you anymore.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay, fine.
Right.
Then who you work for, huh? Who? You don't work for me.
Who? You don't work for me.
Maybe we work for Joel now.
She's only kidding. I hope so. Look, Joel, you look like a smart kid. So I'm going to tell you something which I'm sure you'll understand. Now, you're having fun now, right? Right, Joel? Time of your life. You're sluggish, you can. Never, ever with another man's livelihood. Now, if you're smart, like I hope you are, you're not gonna make me come back here.
Joe Pantoliano and Tom Cruise in a scene from Risky Business. What's the biggest leap that you took in changing your look for a film, your look or your manner?
Oh, gosh. I did a Western called El Diablo, and I played a Truman Capote-type writer of Western novellas, and that was really fun. I mean, I was imitating Katharine Hepburn, and I talked like this, and I was with Anthony Edwards and Lou Gossett Jr., and I had a really, really wonderful time working on it.
That's great. So what's it like now when you're given a new script? Can you read it pretty well?
Yeah. Yeah, I would say that I'm probably... it takes me a couple hours. I would say it takes me a minute. No, it takes me about a half a minute a page, depending on how much dialogue. But... I read a lot now. I enjoy reading, and that was the greatest thing, is the world of books. I collect first editions now. I have a modest collection.
Of what?
Modern day 20th century authors.
Huh. Interesting. You know how you were saying when you were young, you picked up from your mother basically how to BS and how to say what needed to be said to get you by in a situation?
Mm-hmm.
Does that help as an actor? You know, because you had a lot of experience, you know, playing yourself, basically.
You know, I would say that in the last 5 years that 90% of the work, 100% really, in the last couple of years, is offered to me, is maybe I got to go in and talk to the director, that I've earned the privilege of being offered a job.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really nice. But I distinctly remember when I was going into rooms that I realized that good acting was a dime a dozen, that there's a lot of good actors out there. And how was I going to be different? What was I going to do in that room for those 5 minutes that was going to make that director want to hire me? And I thought that if I could show them that I was going to be easy to work with and be charming and fun to be around, that that would give me an opportunity to get closer to that job. And I've always done that. You know, I've been puckering up my whole life.
But in a good way, not a bad way, right?
Well, yeah. I mean that in the nicest way.
In the nicest way. So how has being a movie star changed your standing in the old neighborhood? Do you know anybody else there? Have they all been driven out by gentrification?
See, I don't look at myself as a movie star. I always thought that a movie star is somebody that makes, you know, $5 million, $2 million, $1 million a movie. People see me, and because I'm a personality and that I'm someone that's recognized, they think that I've lived this gorgeous life and I'm driving Maseratis and living in a palace. And I'm here to tell you, Joey Pants doesn't own a palace. I'm just a working actor. And my friends and my family are proud of me. One of the nicest things that was said to me yesterday is my friend Joey Fiano, who I talk about in the book, who's lost his father, and a week later he lost his mother, and at 18 years old raised his siblings. And he called me up yesterday. I hadn't talked to him in 10 years. And he said to me, I'm going to go get the book. And he says, Joey, you got to live all of your dreams. All of your dreams came true. And they have, you know? And now I get to tell this story. So whether nobody reads the book, this is something my kids could read someday, and it's a document of where they came from. I think that's great.
It sounds like your book really was like therapy for you. Have you actually been in therapy?
Yeah, I was in therapy for 15 years. Oh, God.
Did you understand the role that, for instance, your mother had played in your life and how overbearing she was in your life and what impact
I'll tell
that
you
had
how I got into therapy.
Yeah, go ahead.
We were working at O'Neill's Balloon. I was a waiter, and Florey was the manager.
That's a restaurant right near Lincoln Center in Manhattan.
That's right. It's not there anymore, but it's owned by Patrick O'Neill, an actor. And here I am now, an actor who owns a restaurant. I have a restaurant in South Norwalk called Bamboo, Connecticut. My sister Marianne quit school at 15, and she was beside herself, my mother. And I was going to acting school with John Lennon, and one of the kids was taking this group therapy thing. So I said, Ma, there's this guy, he's the group therapy thing. Maybe you should take Marianne and talk to him. Maybe he can help her out. So she did, and they were going to come and meet us at O'Neill's Balloon. Well, my mother was fit to be tied. And I said, what's the matter? She goes, this no good SOB says that your sister's problems are my fault. And I just went like, somebody said this to her? And the next day I called the guy up and I got to meet you, because if you're telling my mother that it's her, that she's the reason we're so screwed up, I have to meet you. And that's how I started the group therapy.
One last thing. When did you first start being called Joey Pants?
The kids called me Joey Pants, and it was always because people couldn't say the name.
Even in an Italian neighborhood?
They call you Pantliana, Pantleone, Pumpliana. I mean, they murdered the English language in that town. And so they would call me Pants. They'd say Pants because, you know, Pantalone means pants in Italian.
Right. Well, thank you so much for talking with us.
I had a ball.
Joe Pantoliano plays Ralphie on The Sopranos. His new memoir about growing up in Hoboken is called Who's Sorry Now? Coming up, linguist Jeff Nunberg on politicians who say nuclear instead of nuclear. This is Fresh Air. Of all the speech errors that politicians make, none seems to draw more criticism than saying nuclear as nuclear. George W. Bush is the most recent in the line of presidents who say nuclear, a mispronunciation that dates back to President Eisenhower. Linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the many reasons why some politicians just don't get it right.
There are two kinds of missteps that people make with language, the typos and the thinkos. Typos are those little processing glitches that sometimes intercede between a thought and its expression. They can make you look foolish, but they aren't really the signs of an intellectual or ethical deficiency the way thinkos are. It's the difference between a sentence that expresses an idea badly and a sentence that expresses a bad idea. People don't pay much attention to that distinction when they take after the errors and malaprops of presidents and other political figures. I've always felt that Dan Quayle got a bum rap over his inability to spell potatoes. I mean, there are people who can spell and people who can't, and God doesn't seem to have paid much attention to other cognitive capacities in spreading that gift around. And while critics were always making fun of Eisenhower's woolly language, it wasn't really a sign of woolly thinking. Most people realized that he was an astute politician, and he could write lucid prose when he felt like it. Ditto former President Bush. He may have had difficulty speaking in complete sentences, but that didn't mean he wasn't thinking in complete thoughts. No president has taken more flack over his language than George W. Bush, not Eisenhower, not even Harding. That's understandable. Bush's malaprops can make him sound like somebody who learned the language over a bad cell phone connection. My education message will resonate among all parents. A tax cut is really one of the anecdotes to coming out of an economic illness. The columnist and talk show hosts have tended to treat those errors as the occasions for mirth rather than concern, the linguistic equivalents of Gerald Ford's pratfalls. Bush himself encouraged that interpretation with those Letterman and Saturday Night Live appearances during the campaign when he made fun of his inability to pronounce subliminal and said he was ambivalent about appearing on the show. It was a shrewd maneuver, as Mark Crispin Miller points out in his recent book, The Bush Dyslexicon, a very penetrating look at Bush and his language. The self-mockery took the edge off the criticisms by painting Bush as just another irrepressible word mangler, sort of a Yaley Casey Stengel. But it isn't always easy to tell whether an error is a typo or a thinko. Take the pronunciation of nuclear as nuclear. That one has been getting on people's nerves since Eisenhower made the mispronunciation famous in the 1950s. In Woody Allen's 1989 film Crimes and Misdemeanors, the Mia Farrow character says she could never fall for any man who says nuclear. That would have ruled out not just W, but Bill Clinton, who said the word right only about half the time. President Carter had his own way of saying the word as nukia, but that probably had more to do with his Georgia accent than his ignorance of English spelling. On the face of things, nuclear is a typo par excellence. People sometimes talk about Bush stumbling over the word, as if this were the same kind of articulatory problem that turns February into February. But nuclear isn't a hard word to pronounce the way February is. Just try saying each of them three times fast. Phonetically, in fact, nuclear is pretty much the same as sicklier or wrinklier, and nobody ever gets them wrong. that nuclear pronunciation is really what linguists call a folk etymology, where the unfamiliar word nuclear is reconfigured as if it had the same suffix as words like molecular or particular. It's the same process that turns chaise longue into chaise lounge. That accounts for Eisenhower's mispronunciation of nuclear back at a time when the word was a new addition to ordinary people's vocabularies. And it's why Homer Simpson says it is nuclear even today. But it doesn't explain why you still hear nuclear from people like politicians, military people, and weapons specialists, most of whom obviously know better and have been reminded repeatedly what the correct pronunciation is. The interesting thing is that those people are perfectly capable of saying nuclear families or nuclear medicine. I once asked a weapons specialist at a federal agency about this, and he told me, "Oh, I only say nuclear when I'm talking about nukes." In the mouths of those people, nuclear is a choice, a thinko, not a typo. I'm not sure exactly what they have in mind by it. Maybe there's an appeal in referring to bombs in such a folksy and familiar way. Or maybe it's a question of asserting their authority, as if to say, we're the ones with our fingers on the button and we'll pronounce the word however we damn well please. But where does Bush's nuclear come from? A lot of people seem to assume that he's just one of those bubbas who don't know any better. But that's hard to credit. After all, Bush didn't have to learn the word nuclear in middle age the way Eisenhower did. He must have heard it said correctly thousands of times when he was growing up, not just at Andover, Yale, and Harvard, but from his own father, who never seems to have had any trouble with the word. But if Bush's nuclear is a deliberate choice, is it something he picked up from the Pentagon wise guys? Or is it a faux bubba pronunciation, the sort of thing he might have started doing at Yale by way of playing the Texas Yahoo to all those earnest Eastern dweebs? Actually, there'd be an easy way to tell. Just look to see how Bush pronounces nuclear in phrases like nuclear family and nuclear medicine. If he says nuclear all the time, then it's most likely a faux bubba thing. But if he only says nuclear for weapons, it's probably a bit of borrowed Pentagon swagger. Anyway, I'll be keeping my ears peeled.
Jeff Nunberg is currently a fellow at the Stanford Humanities Center, and he's the author of the book The Way We Talk Now. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today is Roberta Shurrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Patty Leswing, Jessica Chu, and Lauren Krenzel. Our program was directed today by Anne-Marie Baldonado. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from Delacorte Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Cloud of Sparrows, a debut novel of 19th century Japan by Takashi Matsuoka. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And by Wiley, publishers of Turning Points, a new book series featuring Columbus in the Americas by author William Least Heat Moon. Now at your local BookSense bookseller or wherever books are sold. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, an expert on Iraq makes the case for invading Iraq. We talk to Kenneth Pollack, author of The Threatening Storm. Pollack was director of Gulf Affairs at the National Security Council during the Clinton administration and was an Iran-Iraq military analyst for the CIA during the Gulf War. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.